But the publicity once Tanager's arrested? There won't be any publicity, I said. I'll see to that. Hey friends, how you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sundowns of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me. Alfred Hitchcock and his Mystery Magazine and Bill Pronzini bring us our first story. It's called The Back End of Nowhere. 18 years. 18 long, bitter, difficult years. That was how long it took for Tanager to be found. The law, the FBI, with all their resources, couldn't find him. The private investigators I hired couldn't. But I never gave up hope. I would have gone on searching and believing for the rest of my life until I drew my last breath. It was pure chance that finally exposed him. Blind luck, or maybe a belated act of providence. That, in the lure of a $10,000 reward I'd posted and kept standing. The man who found him, in a remote corner of the Nevada desert of all places, the back end of nowhere, was an insurance salesman, rockhound, and true crime buff named Marshall Logan. Logan had gone out there one of his annual summer rock hunting expeditions. He was a collector of rare minerals and semi-precious stones found in remote areas of Nevada, California, Arizona, and New Mexico. Fire opals and opalized wood, turquoise, garnets, chalcedony, and wonderstones, agates. He was also an avid reader of accounts of factual crime cases, past and present. Logan came to my private office at Ritter & Son Real Estate to tell me the news. The "and son" was a misnomer. Adam Jr. had never had anything to do with the farm, but I felt I owed it to him. He was Marilyn's and my only offspring. In my business, you learn to trust first impressions of people. Mine of Logan was favorable. He was a large man in his middle 30s, earnest and evidently sharp-eyed. Over the past 2 decades, I have had to deal with dozens of phonies only interested in the reward, mostly early on, fewer and fewer as time passed, none in recent memory. And I felt instinctively that he was not one of that breed. The money mattered to him, of course. He freely admitted he could use $10,000. But that was not the sole reason he'd come to see me. I believed him when he said he believed in justice. "Well, I ran into him in an arroyo," Logan told me, "digging with a geologist's hammer. He was so intent on what he was doing and coughing from all the dust in the air that he didn't hear me approach. I got close enough to see the tattoo on his wrist before he realized I was there and covered it with his other hand." "RVT in bright red letters in a black box? You sure?" "Positive. RVT, Tanager's initials, Robert Vernon Tanager. The odds against two men having the exact same wrist tattoo were enormously long."
"You didn't say anything to him about it?"
"No, sir."
"How did he act? Scared? Threatening?"
"Well, startled, mostly," Logan said. "He wanted to know who I was, why I was there. I told him I was hunting semi-precious stones, the same as he seemed to be doing. He didn't say anything else, just turned his back and quick put on a pair of gloves he had looped on his belt. Then he picked up a small sack of specimens, agates from what I could see of his dig, and hurried away."
"Did he have any kind of a weapon?"
"Well, not that I could see."
"How old was he?"
"He had to be in his 50s,
the right age."
"Yes. Tanager had been 34 when he disappeared.
Describe him."
"Thin, sunburnt, dark, a grizzled beard, and graying hair down to his shoulders. The right height, too, 5'8 or so. Dressed in, well, old
shabby clothing. The only picture of Tanager I had ever seen was a police mugshot taken when he was arrested for car theft more than 20 years ago. That image was burned into my mind. He'd been clean-shaven then, pale-skinned, his thick black hair cut short. Hard to imagine an urban criminal born and raised in Chicago as a desert rat even after the passage of so much time. Yet he was shrewd enough to have known how difficult it is to disappear in this technological age, and he must have been scared enough to realize that his best chance of avoiding capture and a life sentence in a federal prison was to adopt a completely new identity and crawl into the kind of hole no one would suspect as a hiding place. I said, "You certain he lives in the area?"
"Oh, yeah, no doubt of it," Logan said. "I asked about him in Pyrite, the nearest town. He goes by the name of Charlie. Lives like a hermit in a shack near an old abandoned gold mine several miles away in the desert. Scratches out a living selling agates and other collectible specimens to the owner of a general store, and doing an occasional odd job."
"How long has he been there?"
"Well, a long time. Nobody seems to know or care exactly when he came. The locals consider him non compos metis, because he always wears gloves when he shows up in town, no matter how hot it is. Tanager, all right."
"Well, so it would seem."
"What are you going to do now, Mr. Ritter?"
"Well, I don't know yet," I said truthfully. "Shouldn't you notify the FBI right away?"
"That's not your concern."
He cleared his throat.
I don't mean to seem mercenary, but about the reward?
"Oh, you'll get it in full when the identification is definite. And if you tell no one else what you've told me and sign a non-disclosure agreement to that effect."
"Oh, well, sure, of course. But the publicity once Tanager gets arrested?"
"Oh, there won't be any publicity," I said.
"I'll see to that."
I did not notify the FBI. Well, not yet. I had to see for myself that the desert rat was Tanager. Then I would decide what to do. I packed a bag that night and left for Nevada early the following morning. I told Marilyn I was going on a business trip to L.A. and might be away for a few days. There was no need to burden her with the truth at this point. I told Adam Jr. the same thing for the same reason. The distance was over 900 miles. I debated trying to drive in one day, but even if I could manage it, it would put me in Nevada desert in the middle of the night and leave me exhausted. Better to stop at a motel somewhere along the way, get a few hours sleep. I would have to be both physically and mentally sharp when I confronted Charlie. As I drove, I could not help reliving those terrible 5 days 18 years ago. The details were still vivid in my memory. Adam Jr.'s sudden disappearance on his way home from school, the exorbitant ransom demand and threat of harm to the boy, Marilyn's near collapse, the agonizing decision to call the FBI because $150,000 was more money than I could possibly raise in short order, the conference with agents, the second demand with instructions for the drop in the section of country land too barren for close-by surveillance, the twofold FBI plan to provide just enough cash to pass a quick first look and to hide an electronic tracking device in the suitcase. The drive to make the drop-off, and then the long, tense wait at home for word of whether the plant had worked and Adam Jr. had been found alive. The news, when it finally came, had been a massive relief, of course. Agents tracked the man who picked up the suitcase to an abandoned cabin in a wooded area, where he was arrested after a brief standoff. Adam Jr. was there, bound, gagged, and blindfolded and physically unharmed. The captured kidnapper, Howard Litchfield, a convicted felon with a long police record, confessed that he had not acted alone. His cohort, Robert Vernon Tanager, the man he claimed had masterminded the abduction, had somehow managed to disappear before the FBI agents arrived. Litchfield had no idea why Tanager hadn't waited in the cabin or where he might have gone. Except for Tanager's escape, that should have been the end of it. But it wasn't. My son was safe, yes, but the ordeal had taken a severe psychological toll on him, from which, well, he never fully recovered. He was a shy, sensitive boy. After the abduction, he became withdrawn, prone to nightmares and fits of depression, afraid to leave the house alone. Therapy had done some positive effects as he grew older, but he was still unable to function on his own, lead a normal life. At age 26, he was in many ways a frightened little boy. Litchfield was paying with a life sentence in Leavenworth for his part in what had been done to Adam Jr., and now, finally, Tanager was about to pay too. One way or another, he would pay, and pay dearly. It was shortly past noon the next day when a narrow secondary road led me through half a dozen miles of sun-blasted desert to Pyrite. According to Marshall Logan, it had once been a thriving mining settlement. Now it was a semi-ghost town with a population of less than 100 that catered to rockhounds, hardscrabble ranchers, backroad tourists, and squatters like Charlie. Its main street was two blocks long and lined with old-fashioned Western-style buildings, only a few of which seemed occupied. Heat shimmers gave them a wavery, mirage-like appearance. The street was deserted except for a few cars and pickups, their dusty metal surfaces gleaming dully under the fiery noonday sun. Parked in front of a tavern and an adjacent general store that advertised rare minerals and gemstones. There was no reason for me to stop. Logan had told me where the abandoned mine and Tanager's shack were located and how to get there by way of an unpaved track beyond the north end of town. I found the track with no difficulty, followed it across rocky cactus-strewn flats, past dry washes and low cinnamon-colored hills, to where a second track, this one barely discernible and washboarded with ruts and potholes, branched off to the east. After half a mile along there, I came around a landfill of fragmented shale and saw the shack at the foot of a low hill 100 yards ahead. I braked immediately, pulled off to the side of the track. The shack was a sagging, jerry-rigged accumulation of weather-beaten lumber and rusted sheet metal that had probably been salvaged from the mine. A crooked stovepipe jutted at an angle from its roof. Nosed up along one side was an ancient, battered pickup truck. On the hillside above and behind, I could make out the crumbling remains of the long-dead mine. Ore tailings, rubble from collapsed buildings, the caved-in mine entrance. I wondered if Tanager had built the shack, or if it had been part of the mine workings, and he had claimed what was left of it and made it habitable. Not that it mattered. There was no sign of activity around the shack, and the only door within my range of vision stayed shut. He had to be inside, or the truck would not be there. My car is a Lexus, its engine one of the quietest made. He must not have heard me coming. Good. The element of surprise would make things easier if he had a weapon. I shrugged out of the light jacket I wore, then opened the console and took out the .32 ACP Beretta that I'd cleaned and loaded before leaving home. Hours of practice at a pistol range had taught me how to fire it with reasonable accuracy. I slipped it into my pants pocket and then left the air-conditioned coolness of the car. It was like stepping out in front of an open maw of a blast furnace. The temperature must have been about 100 degrees. The overheated air, dead still and thick with the smell of sage. There was still no sign of life at the shack as I trudged toward it. All through the long drive, I had kept my emotions under tight control, but now that I was here, close to Tanager and festering hate put a metallic taste in my mouth. The sweat that oozed out of me was not all a result of the heat. I still did not know what I would do when I came face to face with him. I walked more slowly as I neared the shack, my hand slick around the handle of the gun in my pocket. The breathless silence remained unbroken. Next to the closed door, a dust-streaked window, radiating cracks in one corner, was covered with a strip of canvas. Nothing moved behind it. A few feet from the door, the toe of my shoe struck a rock that was hidden and sent it rolling into another with a clatter that seemed loud in the stillness. But it brought no sound of movement inside the shack. At the door, I paused to wipe my vision clear, then leaned close to listen. Now I could hear faint, uneven grunting sounds within. At first, I couldn't identify them. Then, when they came again, I realized that it was the sound of a sleeping man snoring. I did not wait any longer. The door was not locked. I pushed it open with my left hand, at the same time taking out the Beretta with my right, and stepped across the threshold into a miasma of trapped heat, stale cooking odors, sour human effluvium. It took a couple of seconds for my eyes to adjust to the gloom in there. He was lying on a cot opposite a blackened wood stove. He'd heard me come in, but it took him a second longer to rouse out of a heat-heavy sleep. He twisted around awkwardly on the cot, swung scrawny legs off to the floor. He was naked except for a pair of tattered undershorts. His thin body, two-toned, face, neck, forearms, ankles, sunburnt brown, the rest of him pale as curdled milk. He sat there, squinting at me, shaking his head to clear it. What the hell? He said in a croaking voice, broken by a series of dry coughs. What do you want? You Tanager? The name struck him like a blow. He jerked awkwardly to his feet. The only other move he made was to cover the RVT tattoo on his right wrist with left hand. But not before I had a glimpse of it. A little sun faded, but still clear.
That ain't my name. My name's Charlie.
Tanager. Robert Vernon Tanager.
No! More coughing. You got the wrong person.
The right person. Finally, after 18 years.
I don't know you. Who the hell are you?
Adam Ritter. Adam Ritter Jr.'s father. He stood stiff, legs apart, shoulders bent, fully awake now. He'd seen the gun and was staring at it. I stepped farther into the room, out of the doorway, so that more daylight streamed in, and I had a better look at him. Oddly, he didn't seem afraid or panicky, or even anxious. An emotion I couldn't define flickered in his rheumy eyes, tightened the skin on his steamed gray-whiskered face. I said, "You thought you were safe after all this time, didn't you? Never be caught, never be punished." A coating of sweat on his near-naked body gleamed like oil. He ducked his head against his shoulder to get it out of his eyes.
How'd you find me?
Doesn't matter. I'm here now.
Alone, huh? No FBI? No cops?
That's right. Just me.
What are you gonna do? Shoot me?
I could. Shoot you and bury your body in the desert. You'd never be missed. Tanager didn't show any fear. There was a deer rifle on wall hooks between the door and the window, but his eyes never shifted in that direction. He just kept staring at the Beretta.
"I'd have every right to kill you," I said, "after what you and your partner did to my son."
We never done anything to the kid. Never hurt him."
"No, you're wrong about that, Tanager.
You hurt him plenty. He hasn't been well since."
"Yeah, well, too bad. It was Litchfield's idea to snatch him, not mine."
"He said different at the trial. He said it was your idea. He's a liar, and you're not?" Another coughing fit racked him. He reached out to a chair next to the cot, fumbled up a stained handkerchief, and hacked into it. Some of the stains were rust-colored. A new one, when he lowered the cloth, was bright crimson. Blood, both dried and fresh. Logan had been wrong that Tanager's hacking was due to the dust in the air. I waited until the spasm passed before saying, "When did you leave the farmhouse? And why?"
"Well, I had a bad feeling about the payoff," Tanager said. "It took too long to set up. Figured it might be a trap, so I went out and waited in the woods when Litchfield left to make the pickup. He wasn't back 5 minutes when the FBI showed up."
"Then what did you do?"
"What do you think I did? Ran."
"Where'd you go? Not straight out here?"
"No, not for a couple of months. Never mind what I'd done before that."
"And you've been here ever since?"
"Yeah. Stuck in this hellhole all these years."
"You chose it. You could have gone somewhere else."
"Where? Where could I?"
A paroxysm of coughing strangled the next of it. He spat a blob of bright red into the handkerchief.
"Oh, hell with all this talk. Get it over with, Ritter."
"Well, get what over with?"
"Shooting me. That's why you come here by yourself. Why drag it out?"
His voice rose plaintively.
"Go ahead, shoot. Shoot!"
My God, I thought, he wants to die. Quick, not slowly and painfully by whatever's eating him up inside. That was the emotion I had not been able to define before. He wanted to die, and he was too much of a coward to have done it himself.
"Damn you, Ritter! Shoot!"
I did not have enough hate in me to put him out of his misery. Never had enough to exact vengeance by committing cold-blooded murder. The notion that I might have been capable of it when I confronted him had been a delusion. "No," I said again. He saw that I meant it and called me a bunch of vile names. I thought he might be frantic enough to rush me, try to force me to kill him. But he did not have enough courage for that either. Yet another violent coughing spell ended the stream of profanity, and the effort to control it had a sudden deflating effect on him. He collapsed onto the cot and rolled onto his side, drawing his legs up, gasping for breath. I had nothing to fear from him, but as a precaution, I took the rifle off the wall. He did not look my way again as I went out into the flaming desert sun, closing the door behind me. On the way to the car, I glanced back to make sure he was not coming out after me. Then I got rid of the rifle by slotting it in a niche between two chunks of rock. As I drove away from there, I considered whether I should notify the FBI of Tanager's whereabouts. He would be there if I did and they came for him. But there did not seem to be any more point now in having him arrested than in shooting him. I had believed that he'd escaped punishment for the past 18 years, but he hadn't. This place was as much a prison as a cell in Leavenworth would have been or would be. It seemed fitting that he should live out what little of his miserable life remained where he'd incarcerated himself. In the back end of nowhere. All right, I'm going to stay in the same Alfred Hitchcock mystery magazine. Our next story, this one by Bill Cameron, is called Wheel of Fortune. Had he cared to fit in with the other custodians, he might have groused. "I've run the buffer up this hallway more times than my daddy whipped me."
But that would be a lie, for Caspar Bressman had never known his father, and he was a diligent record keeper. Growing up in a Latvian orphanage in a small town outside Riga had drilled into him the need to keep track. It was the only way to be sure he got what little was due him, whether it was treats from chores or the correct number of socks back from the laundry. Now as an adult, Caspar had kept data on everything. Feral cats in the alleyway behind the apartment, the arguments and intimacies of his neighbors, package and food deliveries to his building. On a personal level, he recorded the hours he slept, the foods he ate, and the distance walked or covered on his bicycle. In his student days, he tracked the last with a map. Now, the device in his pocket recorded his movements to the exact step or meter. He could tell you his blood pressure on any date or his heart rate and body temperature. And he knew the number and length of his calls with his daughter, Lena, now in her first year at university, 10 time zones to the east. So he knew. He waxed the ground floor corridor of Pearson Hall 63 times since he started working at Enderley University. During that same period, he'd emptied 11,775 wastebaskets and scrubbed 3,768 toilets. 7 times he'd cleaned the blinds on 94 windows, and exactly once he corrected someone's math. For that, they threatened him with jail. Enderley was Caspar's 5th stop since arriving in America. His first job, accepted on a temporary basis with payment under the table, had been with a company that serviced a New Jersey community college. He didn't mind custodial work. It got him through the University of Latvia, after all. But he hoped to find a position commensurate with his education and experience once he got his immigration status in order. Yet no institution would hire him. His doctorate and years of teaching weren't enough to convince faculty committees once they learned why he'd fled Europe. He moved west, time zone by time zone, keeping up with his field through journals in university libraries. But as months became years, he failed to land even a position as an adjunct teaching introductory courses to first-year students. When an Idaho liberal arts college let him go on the grounds that even a custodian with his history brought dispute to the institution, the harsh reality grew impossible to ignore. Using his meager savings and a furtive introduction from another custodian, he bought a new identity and moved once more. At Enderley, in what felt like one last twist of the knife, they assigned him to the very building where he might have worked as a professor. Not that anyone at his latest stop knew of his past, as the disgraced Kazimir Brisma. His only remaining links to his old life were 2 rare video chats with his daughter and his pointless habit of reading academic journals. And, in one of those journals, perused a few months into his Enderley sojourn, he read an item that stoked the last fading ember inside him. Caspar had no access to the working labs in Pearson Hall. Only researchers and their most advanced students could open the digital locks on the security door. But that left offices, classrooms, conferences, and computer rooms, as well as lavatories and public areas. The office shared by graduate students, 2 or 3 in a place inadequate for one, were a mess of books, papers, and knickknacks, but most of the areas he covered barely required his attention. He ran afoul of the law in a large room with multiple workstations and walls covered with whiteboards. A formidable steel door at the rear led to one of the inaccessible labs. The only personal touches were on the back of the door, where people had taped up memes, science comics from The New Yorker, and tongue-in-cheek reports from Darwin Award winners. The rest of the space was almost sterile, so much that he half wondered why they needed a custodian at all. The researchers didn't leave their work out. He never had to clear a work surface before wiping it down. Locked retractable screens hid the whiteboards. The trash cans only held empty coffee cups, food wrappers, and spent markers. Discarded printouts and written notes went into shredders. The computers were always asleep, their secrets locked behind passwords. But the night he waxed the corridor for the 63rd time, he found one of the whiteboard screens open, an aberrant datum, but statistically significant, considering what he found on the back of the door. Someone had added an incongruous tarot card to the memes and cartoons, The Wheel of Fortune. Though a dedicated scientist, he knew enough from his ex-wife, Mina, that the wheel represented a change in direction, for good and for ill. An aficionado, if not precisely an adherent of the tarot, she could explain the more subtle and nuanced meanings of the card. Caspar wondered if the person who taped it up imagined a change for the better. Or maybe it was tongue-in-cheek, the way he'd used the tarot card himself back in his former life. Caspar would see. He had the room to himself, the entire basement, in fact. The two other custodians working at Pearson Hall would be on their own floors. No graduate students were working late, an uncommon occurrence, since he'd logged only 31 times. Curious, he studied the whiteboard. There were notes and some odd chemical formula, but a statistical calculation caught his eye. Someone had been working out a p-value, and they'd made a mistake. The calculation wasn't a difficult one, though tedious to perform by hand. For a large data set, computers would do this kind of work. Caspar suspected an exercise set for one of the research assistants. A mistake here, Caspar saw, was one of simple arithmetic. The assistant subtracted the observed result from the expected, rather than the other way around. A foolish error, the kind one made when accustomed to letting a computer perform one's arithmetic. Caspar almost turned away, but he had a thought. This might be just the opportunity he'd been looking for. He spent a moment with an eraser and whiteboard marker. The corrected result moved the p-value into a range where the results were effectively random. Not that it mattered, especially if the problem was a penalty for some careless student. Pearson Hall was home to biological sciences. Whatever those assigned to this room were studying, the actual work happened elsewhere, most likely behind the locked security doors at the back of the room, the door he couldn't open. He pulled the screen down over the whiteboard and left it slightly ajar. When he emptied the waste bins, wiped down the work surfaces with disinfectant, swept the floor, and left. The only question now was, would anyone notice what he'd done? At home, he tried to reach his daughter in Riga via video chat. When the connection attempt timed out, he checked his blood pressure and recorded the results in his spreadsheet, slightly elevated. He logged several other data points from his evening, including the uncovered whiteboard, then brushed his teeth and went to bed. A few short hours later, his cell phone buzzed, startling him awake. Lena? But no, it was Enderley's director of facilities, a blustery man who insisted everyone call him Bobby.
Hey, pal, sorry for waking you, but I need you to come in.
Sooner than he expected, Caspar kept the satisfaction out of his voice. Right now, Mr. Hale. After all, his shift didn't start until 4.
Yeah, something we gotta talk about.
When he arrived, a severe-looking woman in an anonymous beige suit was waiting with his supervisor. Neither asked him to sit.
Kaz, Hale began, how'd things go last night?
An innocuous question, as if anyone cared about the work he did. They'd only care if he didn't do it. He never had an issue in 214 shifts.
I covered all my areas. He carefully enunciated each syllable. If he rushed, his English had a Latvian lilt that caused American listeners to ask uncomfortable questions about his background. The woman cleared her throat. Mr. Pressman, I'm Sergeant Alice Price with the campus police. She pulled a wallet from her jacket and opened it, flashing its contents. He recognized the university identification card, differing from his own only by the gold shield in one corner. She'd affixed a matching badge to the leather flap next to the card. It looked like chromed plastic. Is there a problem? He glanced at Hale, who shifted in his chair, fingers steepled under his chin. You work in Pearson Hall, Sergeant Price said. Yes. Ground floor? That's right. Last night, did you clean 4B? The room with the incorrect p-value calculation and the tarot card? Yes, I cleaned 4B. And you broke into one of the locked whiteboards. The screens were open. Did you mess with someone's math? Caspar had learned the hard way that the police usually knew the answers before they asked their questions. His keycard had opened 4B's doors, a data point. No one else had been on the floor last night, another data point. He knew too well that while data could be manipulated, it didn't lie, but he didn't need to lie. I noticed the calculation, and you messed with it. Changed figures on the board? I corrected an error. His supervisor chuckled, drawing a frown from Sergeant Price. You think this is funny, Bobby? A janitor fixing Mr. Dr. Professor's math? Hale's jowl shook. It's hilarious. All his life, when Caspar saw a problem, he'd try to fix it. In Riga, the urge cost him everything. His job, his reputation, and when the investigation ended, his wife and his daughter. That was why Caspar was here now, 8,000 kilometers from home, working as a janitor instead of a respected scientist. It was why Mina would never speak to him again, why he could only see Lena by video. Once upon a time, Kazimir Brisma had been a professor. He no longer held that title, but he'd earned the degree. He might say as much now, but to what end? The information would gain him no respect, only suspicion, because if they learned he held his degree under another name... Sergeant Price's lips drew into a line. I'm not laughing. I've been told to investigate this as an attempt at intellectual property sabotage. Her sharp eyes returned to Caspar. You could be liable for civil and federal criminal penalties. I corrected an error. He kept his voice steady. A trivial one at that. No researcher of any worth would scrawl proprietary data on a whiteboard in an area open to custodial staff. I have no access to the labs themselves. I could sabotage nothing, even if I wanted to. Caspar didn't mention he recognized the hand that scrawled the figures, not the hand of whoever bungled the calculation, but that of the man who wrote the data awry, as well as the other notes on the board. Sergeant Price studied him, and for a moment he'd worried he'd said too much. The average custodian probably didn't use, like, proprietary data. But then she let out a breath. Bobby, what are your thoughts? His supervisor leaned back in his chair. Well, Kaz is a good man, hard worker, never a lick of trouble, and I'm sure he didn't mean nothing by it. Sergeant Price turned to Caspar. Do you want to end up in jail? It wasn't the first time he'd been the target of such a threat. No. Then watch yourself. To Hale, she said, I'll consider this matter closed. She threw Caspar a sour look. For now. When she left, Bobby Hale gave an exaggerated shrug. You know, the university just landed a partnership with some high-powered pharma outfit. The lead researcher is pretty touchy about security. We can't have our custodian screwing around. Oh, I meant no impertinence. Caspar's first lie. Oh, sure you didn't. Hale swallowed a chuckle. I gotta move you. I'm afraid and you're suspended until I sort out the schedule. A week, probably. But when you come back, you'll be in one of those squishy departments. Bachelor Hall, maybe, English? One eyebrow bobbed up. Don't go revising any turn papers. This was fine with Caspar, but he didn't want to seem to acquiesce too easily. I can't afford to lose a week's pay. He tried to sound distressed. I assure you, I can focus on my duties without... No, sorry, Kaz. Dr. Kozlov doesn't want you anywhere near his lab. Caspar felt his face redden at the name. His first genuine reaction. Hale didn't seem to notice. Now, clear out or it'll be 2 weeks. On the way home, he thought about the notice he'd read in the journal and later confirmed on the research and innovation page of the Enderley website. The announcement came via a florid press release. Dr. Edik Kozlov, formerly of the Riga Medical College at the University of Latvia, had accepted a research chair at Enderley University, partly funded by a grant from a privately held pharmaceutical firm. Dr. Kozlov brought with him the project that cost Caspar everything. Caspar had intended it as an act of kindness. Mina's father was dying, and Caspar knew of research that might extend the old man's life. Not a project he worked on, but one led by his former doctoral advisor, Edik Kozlov. They'd had a fraught relationship during his studies. Caspar thought the man should have shared more credit with his staff, while Kozlov found Caspar too data-focused. "Your lack of an academic imagination will keep you mired in the pedestrian," the man said during one of those occasions when he assigned Caspar some problem to solve by hand. As if mathematical drudgery would spark anyone's imagination. But once Caspar earned his doctorate, the two grew more cordial, perhaps because they no longer worked together. To neither surprise, Caspar never advanced much original research. He preferred teaching or performing data analysis for other project leads. In contrast, Kozlov pushed the boundaries of his field. His team had reached human clinical trials for a promising pancreatic exocrine tumor treatment around the time Mina's father was diagnosed with the aggressive cancer. Caspar wasn't close to the old man, but Mina adored him. And Caspar adored Mina. They'd met their first year of university in a poetry class he took on a lark. He could craft only mechanical, uninspired verse, but his earnestness caught Mina's eye. Her artist spirit seemed to complement his scientific mind. "We're good for each other," she said the first time she read his tarot. "The cards don't lie." Her eyes twinkled with wry humor, knowing he didn't believe in the arcane. But during their time in university, they'd become inseparable and married the week after graduation. Lena arrived a year later. It was Mina who convinced Caspar to continue his education, pointing out his analytical mind was a natural fit for academia. She taught primary school until Caspar finished his doctorate. Then she opened a bookshop and tea room, decorated with prints of the major arcana from the Tarot de Marseille. They were happy as parents, happy as husband and wife. The first darkness in their lives together, as far as Caspar knew, didn't appear until Mina learned of her father's grim diagnosis. And so Caspar turned to Kozlov. "Yes, I suppose I can wedge him in," the former advisor said. But Kozlov made a mistake. The old man had a drug sensitivity, something researchers would have caught had he applied for the trial through normal channels. In slipping him in at the last moment, Kozlov neglected the screening. Never detail-oriented, he relied on his staff to handle minutiae, while he focused on big ideas.
The trial compromised a cocktail of drugs, including one in the same family as a medication to which Mina's father was allergic. On the first day of the trial, he died of anaphylactic shock. As horrible as that was, and as devastating to Mina, things would only get worse. The university opened an investigation into the death. Suddenly, Kozlov had no knowledge of how Kaspar's father-in-law got added to the trial. He admitted Kaspar had approached him about it, but Kozlov claimed he'd regretfully said the study could accommodate no more patients. But he did recall that during the visit when Kaspar made his request, a colleague interrupted with a question. Kozlov stepped out of the office for several minutes to discuss the matter. He could only surmise, but perhaps Kaspar had contrived to insert his father-in-law's name then. A forensic review showed the old man's record added to the trial database after Kaspar logged into the system from Kozlov's computer. Kaspar's denials fell on deaf ears. He never knew how the man got his login credentials, but it wasn't exactly a secret that he chose his password by drawing from a card deck, a wink to Mina, and amusement at the idea of a man of science using a tool of mystics. He stuck with the minor arcana, the numbered suits, since the IT department insisted on at least one numeral in all passwords. He usually hid the current card under his keyboard to help him keep track. In the end, despite his protests, Kaspar's fate was sealed. He knew why. Kozlov, a man of academic imagination, had a reputation to protect. Kaspar was nobody. Perhaps Kozlov didn't expect the consequences to be so severe, but a man had died, and all evidence pointed to Kazimir Bryzma. Authorities deemed the act unethical, irresponsible, and negligent. Only by agreeing to resign and accept full responsibility did he avoid criminal sanction. The university convinced the prosecutor a trial would be in no one's interest. Mina, horrified by his actions and overwhelmed by grief, left him before the ink on his resignation letter dried. Lena understood that he'd only wanted to keep her grandfather, but she stayed with her mother, left with nothing but the devastation of his colleague's betrayal and his wife's rejection. He fled Latvia. When he got home from Mr. Hale's office, he tried to reach Lena without success. Short of sleep, he went to bed, but tossed and turned for several hours. Though things had gone as he'd hoped, better even, he couldn't shake the grim memories bubbling up as he dozed. Mina and her father, the ethics committee at Riga, all warred for his attention. At last he rose and logged his time. Sleep, awake, darkly dreaming, awake again. This many minutes thrashing. That many feeling his pillow grow damp with sweat. He'd sleep better once he finished what he started. Leaving his shabby apartment, he walked to the university, 2.74 miles. The facility's building required his keycard, currently disabled pending his reassignment, but smokers often left the employee's door propped open with a brick. The first time he walked past, he found the door locked. Half an hour later, he watched from the trees across the parking lot as a man came out, stuck the brick in the doorway, and lit up. When the fellow stubbed his cigarette out and returned to work, he left the brick in place. Kaspar trotted across the parking lot under deepening twilight and slipped inside. Seconds later, he was outside Bobby Hale's office. Now, after hours, the office was locked and dark. No matter. During his years as a custodian, Kaspar had learned a few tricks. Housed in one of Enderley's older buildings, he knew he could open doors in a physical plant, by lifting upward on the knob, then pushing forward sharply. 3.5 kilograms of force on the worn lock mechanism got him into his supervisor's office. Let Bobby Hale laugh about a mere custodian correcting a professor's math. The computer was asleep, but Hale talked endlessly about his dog. Caspar had seen him tap the beast's name as F!LB3RT into the password field. One time, a single datum, but statistically significant. A few minutes later, Caspar slipped out of the office and crossed the campus 0.4 miles to Pearson Hall. The night had come on cool and dark. He watched the lights in the windows, saw where the custodial staff were working. He picked a door the furthest away from any activity and used the key card he'd made in Hale's office. The card worked on the door to 4B as well. Of course it worked. He was an educated man. He knew what he was doing. The door in the back wall, the one he'd never entered, also opened for the first time he passed through. He found himself a corridor, crowded with stainless carts on wheels. Farther down, he saw more security doors, but he didn't need to go that far. To his left, an engraved plastic plaque on an office door showed him the way. Dr. Edik Kozlov, lead researcher. One more card swipe, and he was inside. The cluttered space was smaller than Kozlov's former office in Latvia. Likely he had a more spacious office elsewhere on campus, one appropriate for a research chair. This was where he did his actual work, or, rather, where he told his subordinates what to do. Caspar took a few seconds to breathe the air. He caught a faint whiff of disinfectant. Tucked into Kozlov's framed doctorate on the wall, Caspar spotted a card, one of the minor arcana. He needed several tries to get the correct combination of characters to unlock Kozlov's computer. 3 pound of cups. It helped that he knew Enderly IT required a special character and a number in all passwords. He almost laughed. Kozlov could accuse him of lacking academic imagination, yet the man stole his own trick. Perhaps, he thought, a scientist who resorted to superstition deserved what he got. But Caspar, then Casimir, had simply loved his wife and enjoyed a little reminder of who she was each time he set a new password. Cups represented emotional intelligence, while 3 were generative, building cards. Caspar worked through the night, digging through files, reviewing database records, making copies, then building something new. Subtle, far more subtle than when he'd corrected the calculation on the whiteboard. His plan was simple in conception, if complicated in execution. Before he left, he rooted through the desk and found Kozlov's tarot deck, but he didn't draw at random. He shuffled until he found a particular card, then slipped it behind the 3 of cups in the frame. Later, perhaps, when it was too late, Kozlov might understand the message behind the upright tower card. Upheaval. Destruction. Chaos. Caspar returned home and slept the sleep of the damned. 3 weeks later, while working in the English department, no locked whiteboards, no double-secured doors, he picked up a copy of the campus newspaper, a thin publication, 8 pages dense with ads. They posted most news online, but the story was there, in print, on the bottom of the front page. A recently appointed research professor was under investigation for falsifying data. They had discovered the actual data through forensic review of the professor's files. promising results, but apparently not good enough for a man working under the demanding scrutiny of a private sector research partner. The professor had already returned to his home in Latvia, supposedly to consult with family and former colleagues. But unnamed sources said his grant had already been revoked and his position at the university terminated. Furthermore, Riga Medical College had announced they reevaluated the professor's past work there, including the death of a participant in one of his earlier drug trials, a death he'd blamed on the actions of a colleague. That night, Kaspar got through to Lena on his first attempt. "Oh, at long last," he said. "Things may turn around." Well, folks, that's going to wrap up this issue of The Mystery Hour here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying thank you so much for joining me and tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.